Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Robert Thomas. Robert Thomas's first book, entitled Door to Door, published by Fordham University Press in 2002, was chosen by Youssef Kamanyaka as the winner of the Poets Out Loud Prize. And in 2003, he received a poetry fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts. He has published poems in The Atlantic Monthly, Field, The Iowa Review, New England Review, and many other magazines. He and his wife live in San Francisco. His new book, published by Carnegie Mellon University Press, is entitled Dragging the Lake. Hi, Robert. How you doing?
Hi. Good to be here.
Yeah, Robert is here all the way from San Francisco, so we're excited. But you're going to start with some poems from Dragging the Lake.
Yes, and I'm going to do several poems from Dragging the Lake, actually. I will start with one of the shorter poems. There are a lot of long poems in this book. This is called The Muse's Complaint, Take This Job and Shove It. I might mention the allusion to Johnny Paycheck. If you're not familiar with him, Johnny Paycheck was an actual country western singer who wrote the song Take This Job and Shove It. And the poem, I think, kind of falls into place if you pay attention to the title, The Muse's Complaint. It really is in the voice of the muse talking to the poet who she's rather upset with. And she's saying, The Muse's Complaint, take this job and shove it. You watched as I rode my bike for a butter stick. You watched from the choir as I returned to my pew from the communion rail, counting the red tile. When I ran out of gas next to a garlic farm and went down a furrow to the dark garage. When I danced at my brother's wedding, stomping my boots without wasting one drop of champagne. You were there. You loomed, likening me to a diamond can opener or a one-woman bevy of quail, but always likening me. I bled, and to you I was a page-turner. I wept, and for you, the Mokihana bloomed red on Mount Wa'ialeale. You don't even know that Johnny Paycheck died last month, whose obituary said he shot a man in an Ohio watering hole, capitalized the C in his name a few years later, and wrote three great songs, one of which is remembered. What about your obit? That you fed lambs with an eyedropper? You milked the great bear? I've had it up to here with your marching band. I'm taking off my spandex epaulettes. The next time I toss my flaming baton, I'll be in another state when it comes down. And on your honeymoon, I'll be the ah-ah, the glorious trillion-spined black lava slicing through your flip-flops. I'll read the opening poem in this book. This is called The Varieties of Love. It's in seven short sections. The sections I might mention are, other than the title, The Varieties of Love, there's not really a narrative connection between them. I guess I should also mention that the Jan in the first connection has no connection with you.
Okay.
The Varieties of Love. One, Jan and her boyfriend rented movies, stayed up all night, and made love after each film. This to Jan was sublime, sex with the afterimage of a blue car driving past orange shop windows, mannequins illuminated by headlights through the slow black and back and forth of wipers. 2 hours later, the black and white grain of concrete panned by searchlights as a man struggles over the Berlin Wall. Near morning, a handful of skaters crisscross a lake on the outskirts of a mining town. No soundtrack but the thresh of blades on ice. Two, there are four kinds of lovers. Those who love the roses, Ehigala, Mojave, Satchmo, Lemon Pillar, Whiskey Mac. Those who love their parts, Oracle, Corum, Panicle, Rackus, Umbel. Those who love the mulch, pine bark, cedar chip, cocoa hull, leaf mold, potash, and those who love the cities they come from, Lijiang, Tashkent, Nootka, Algeciras, Baton Rouge. Three, Patrick died in his bed in his pajamas. his son brushing strands of white hair from his forehead, his wife on his right holding his hand, his mistress on his left holding the other, his eyes staring at the ceiling, a prime minister enjoying the brief unity his parliament grants him now that the war has begun. 4. The art studio is near the ocean across from the zoo. At night, Allison could hear the lions and the surf. Once she got in through a back gate after closing and watched the flamingos sleep, black beaks curved into their breasts, and realized she couldn't love Beth anymore. It was because of the edge, the scent, the watershed, the carved, the damp, the effulgent, everything that was part of her now. 5. The gold of the silkscreen snow on the card still on Tina's dresser. The gold of the sun that rose as she ground her coffee. The gold that burst from the barrel as she pushed the trigger with both thumbs. The gold threads of the blanket they found her curled on, her knees tucked up so she would fit within the green symmetrical borders. 6. Whenever Enrique was in New York, he went to see the painting of the almond tree. If he had to choose between the painting's destruction and the death of his own family, of course the choice would be clear. But what if he had to choose between the painting and the life of the man who read his meter through a rusted grate, or the lives of some chop house diners in a distant city? Could he still be sure? The charged blue of the sky, how it picked up the branches' undertones, that was irreplaceable. 7. What surprised Nathaniel was not that there was no God nor that he had stopped believing in one, but that his belief had ceased without his noticing. How many shades of green there were in the wilderness. How many evenings in each throat. How naked the salt lick stood in the city square.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Robert Thomas, and he's reading from his new book called Dragging the Lake. So I want to ask you about your process, because I don't usually start out with that question, but when you're reading a poem or when I'm reading your book, I have this feeling that I have no idea where I'm going. and sometimes after you've read, I'm not sure, you know, where I've been. Not to say that your poems are confusing at all, but you make such interesting and odd sometimes leaps. So I'm wondering a little bit about your writing process and how you come up with these poems with no narrative connections.
Well, I suppose I like the idea of poems that do make a lot of leaps. I mean, probably with that poem I just read, I came up with the idea of the varieties of love and kind of started with there, and it got further and further. So when I'm talking about Enrique and the painting of the almond tree, it's hard even there to see a connection to the to the overall concept of the varieties of love and the idea of Nathaniel and there was no God. I've sort of I've gotten pretty far afield from that, and I do like that. I mean, I like the idea of not knowing where I'm going. I have one friend who says he always knows the last line of a poem before he starts. I mean, that's where he starts. That's his process, and that's as far as I can imagine. I can't imagine doing that.
I can't either. And I'm sure you've met people who say they start with the title of their poem, and I never understood that either.
No, I can't do that. I have a hard time. I usually come up with titles way after the fact. Although occasionally, someone will say, you know, they have no clue what's going on in a poem, and I'll sort of say something, and they say, oh, well, you could just put that in a two-word title, and that would make it clear. And sometimes, like the Muse's Complaint, take this job and shove it. Mm-hmm. That sort of clarified the poem for a lot of people, and I don't mind if it's clear.
Right. Well, so then how do you do it? I mean, if in the writing process you just do a lot of free writing and write big hunks of prose, or what, do you have one way that you get to a poem?
I would say it varies a lot from poem to poem, especially in the longer poems. I start out with kind of an overall structure. There's a long poem in this book that I probably won't get around to reading anything from, but it's all in the voice of the cellist Jacqueline Dupre as she talks to her therapist in these sessions with her therapist. And like when you're talking to a therapist, there's kind of an overall structure of free association. So it's very free. But at the same time, there's a kind of urgency to it because you're there trying to confront some problem you're facing in life. So you're not just kind of going off on tangents without any sense of urgency.
Or you might be.
Yeah, that's right. And the challenge in the poem is to try to be free and be associative and yet keep a sense of urgency because you don't want to lose that. And also, as when you talk to a therapist, there are like little mini narratives. You know, you might start out saying, talking about an argument you had with your boss the week before, and that reminds you of a birthday party you had when you were 10 years old. So, so the poem or the story is hopping all over the place. But you do, you know, you tell the story of the birthday party.
Sure.
And you tell the story of the argument. So there are like mini narratives within an overall freer structure of leaping around. And that's, I like that idea.
Okay. Can you read more poems?
Sure.
Okay.
Well, maybe I'll read from one long poem in this book, just a couple sections. This is called Diary of One Who Vanished. And it's all about the early 20th century composer Leos Janáček. Because it's a long poem, I do have to give a little background with this. If you're not familiar with his music but have seen the film of The Unbearable Lightness of Being, the soundtrack is all Janáček's music. He was a Czech composer. And he was married to a woman named Zdenka. This is in the early part of the 20th century. And he fell madly in love with this other woman named Kamala Stoslova. And their relationship was probably platonic, but he wrote her hundreds and maybe thousands of love letters over the course of the last few years of his life. Sometimes he'd write two or three love letters a day. And I'm going to read, the poem is in the form of his letters to her, and I'm going to read just two of them. The whole poem is actually 12 letters, and I'll read maybe one from the beginning of the series and one towards the end of the series. They lived in the town of Brno in what's now the Czech Republic. And Janáček had an opera that was called The House of the Dead. I guess you need to know that too. So here's one letter. Brno, the 3rd of May, 1927. My Kamilka. The finches woke me up early, clicking like maniacs. I'm serious, that rhythm of a ratchet wheel, just like the chit-chat I heard at the asylum. What's my name? Jesus came. Where's my home? Cage of Rome. What is love? Squirt and shove. I transcribed it faithfully. I spent 2 weeks in the women's ward to get the inflections just right for Mila's mother and my destiny. I don't know why I thought I ever had to leave home. My first memory is mother scaring me in our apiary. Bees hidden in darkness. I saw only the glistening of honey. No buzz, but the quiet hum of wing muscles warming a winter hive. Have you seen the cave paintings of men with torches terrorizing a hive with fire so they can gorge on its honey? What a species we are, Kamala. Mother explained how drones first have to get used to a new queen scent or else they'll kill her. And so you plug the hole between her and the hive with a cork of candied sugar thick enough that by the time they eat through to her, they know her smell just enough to let her live. It's easy to botch. Red finches, you know, sing their silky lays only when they're at rest in the elms. But when they fly, it's that raucous ack-ack. That's the sound I want. Can't get back? Chop and hack. How to lick? Hush-hush, quick. Who there knocks? Roots, rags, rocks. That's the tune for my House of the Dead. No harp or violin, but three saws and a file's harsh rasp scraping at the prisoner's chains. House of the Dead and the orchestra really did have parts for a file and saw, and it was about prisoners in a dungeon. One of Janáček's traits as a composer was he would go out into public places, or in this case, to an insane asylum, and take notes on the rhythms and inflections of people's voices and try to incorporate them into his music. I'll read one more from this long series. Luakovice is a sort of resort spa town in the mountains of what's now the Czech Republic. And Leos and Kamala first met there. Both of their families used to go there every summer for a short vacation. Luakovice, the 28th of August, 1927. You, my soul of roses, I go home tomorrow. Discouraged as usual, I can't finish one fantasia. I can't concentrate without you next to me any more than I can with you here. But a strange thing happened this morning as I sat by the carousel jotting notes on the rhythms of footsteps, a cleric's, a shop girl's, a dog chasing a cherry branch. Suddenly there was a boy spilling cocoa on my summer suit, and I began to weep. His mother didn't know whether to slap me to bring me to my senses or to yell at her son, who by now was fascinated, as if I were one of those plaster statues of saints with tears welling from its painted eyes. But he was determined to examine me close enough to figure it out. My Vladimir was stubborn like that when he wanted to play with my watch, his small hands working it out of its snug pocket. I think of him every day, Kama, but not with real feeling. Then this morning, I remembered everything, but to call it remembering is laughable. When I saw the suspenders on the toddler's overalls, I was fastening little Vladicek's blue buttons on a Sunday morning. The wet, woolly smell of the church and the taste of apple ice cream we got on our way back home even in winter mixed together in my mind as they likely had in his as well. How fast the brain must run to keep pace with the heart. I saw pink ice on his lips, and then I was kissing the sweat from his eyes when scarlet fever filled him till there was no room for it and him in his furnace of skin. And I was thinking of how I would write this letter, and of how grief might win me more than an innocent kiss the next time you walk down the yellow sand path to my door. And thinking, too, of scenes with the boy Alyeha in my House of the Dead. How I must add a gay clarinet and honking trombone to banish any whiff of kitsch. The boy's mother was still gently swabbing with her handkerchief the stains from my lapel. And I thought, for the first time, what it must have meant to Zdenka to come to me after our son's death, feral with desire for another child. To ask me to take the clips from her hair, and to watch me turn and walk down the hall to our white piano.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Robert Thomas, reading from his new book entitled Dragging the Lake, published by Carnegie Mellon University Press. So these voices that you sort of inhabit and these monologues that you write, you know, what sort of drives you to inhabit voices from another time? I mean,
yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, one Aga Shahid Ali, the poet, wrote a lot of poems in persona and dramatic monologues, and he talked about really the only purpose of doing it is to explore areas of yourself that you can't get to more easily in any other way. Mm-hmm. Like an actor, I mean, I think an actor does that. You find parts of yourself in roles that you play, and very possibly you find deeper parts of yourself than you do when you talk in your own voice. I mean, you know, you may find out more deeply about Marlon Brando when he's playing Stanley Kowalski than you do when he's, you know, being interviewed by Larry King or something. So there is that urge to explore sides of yourself. Mm-hmm. That you wouldn't discover if you were only talking as your conscious self. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it is a challenge. You know, when you write about yourself directly, there's always a challenge to get some sort of distance from mm-hmm. yourself so you aren't just being self-indulgent. But when you write about someone like an early 20th century composer, then you have, you know, the opposite challenge, which is how do you make it, you know, real and risky and threatening and sort mm-hmm. of have a gut level reality to it, so it's not just a kind of academic exercise.
Right. Well, do you find it easier to take risks with the sort of protection of the dramatic monologue or not? I'd like to have the character or the speaker take risks.
Yeah, I suppose that may be true, that it's easier to take those risks. I may read another poem that's about my mother that was a very personal poem, but in which even there I found it easier to approach a subject when I ended up writing the poem in her voice instead of in my own voice. So that was very personal, writing something in the voice of my mother, but still it gave me a certain amount of distance there. I also feel that writing about historical facts, it helps me feel like the poem has a certain grounding. I mean, I tend to be a very inward kind of surreal poet, sort of magical realism, that sort of thing, dreamlike. And writing about historical figures and historical facts keeps me from going too far off into fantasy land. And, and in that sense, hopefully the idea is that it ends up giving the poems greater depth because it keeps them grounded in the real world.
I just want to say I love a lot of your images and how evocative your details in it are. And sometimes if I'm sort of floating in one of your poems, when I come upon these details, it also grounds me besides the history. But okay, we have time for more poems.
Okay, maybe I'll read one or two from my first book, Door to Door. Well, I could read this one poem, Quarter Past Blue, which is in a way very similar to the poem Complaint of the Muse I read, because I also imagine this as being in the voice of the muse sort of standing outside my window looking in at me as I'm working on a poem, and she's getting annoyed at me and wants me to just come out and put my stupid poetry aside and go outside and look up at the sky and the clouds. Quarter Past Blue. It's just the sort of paper-thin night to make me steal the clapper from the mission bell and leave it on your doorstep like a stuttered prayer. In your room, I see a writing light, soft and dirty as an oyster. I know you can hear me out here in the static, scraping on your pane like a raccoon. I've been to the pond. It's not as if the swans were your personal secret. Come out and walk with me across the Sonoma Town Square on the edge of the green. I'm wearing my papier-mâché wings, and they're not yet dry. The moon's been released on its own recognizance. This is serious traffic, gridlock intergalactical, Friday night lust and spleen. This is the it they mean when they say this is it. You are so caught up in your own devotions. You are so not what you think you are. It's late, half past revelation, quarter past blue, and you're still counting the chits, waiting for something better than love as cold and magical as dry ice to come along and sideswipe you, hit and run without leaving a scratch. And maybe I'll read one more from this book, the one I mentioned about my mother. This is called Ensenada Wedding. Actually, when I was about 20 years old, my parents were divorced when I was a baby. And my father happened to mention in passing how he and my mother had eloped to Mexico to get married. And I had never heard this story. My mother had never told me about it, and my father didn't realize that she hadn't. So I ended up writing a poem about it, and I couldn't figure out quite how to write it until I put it in her voice. Ensenada Wedding. It was just across the border. Your father and I had a pitcher of martinis. The drink back then. I hear it's back, and we competed with our friends for the best expression for a dry martini. I want it so dry a scorpion would feel at home basking on the olive. Of course, I insisted on separate rooms. In those days, people drank so hard and danced so soft they hardly even needed sex. But the next morning, your father had on a starched shirt and a navy blue tie and a coat despite the heat when he picked me up for breakfast. He was so tall we didn't have to wait when he hailed a cab. He took me straight to Iglesia de San Juan de la Cruz. I'd never seen streets like that. Our cab was bigger than some of the hovels, and I remember the smell of the meat. When we got there, the church surprised me. Hand-painted stations of the cross, incense, the red candle hung from the rafters advertising God's presence like a barker. I almost could have drunk the holy water. Of course, I knew the father had paid off the priest. He had to. He was divorced. Enough pesos, the father said, that the church could get a new roof. He knew right away he shouldn't have mentioned the money in front of me. I had my hair in a French twist and wore a milk-white suit. While we waited for the priest to fetch his house cleaner and her 8-year-old granddaughter to witness, a cloudburst came out of nowhere. It sounded as if the whole town were hurling stones against the blue-stained glass. That was the closest I ever felt to your father. Our room overlooked the plaza, children hawking pinwheels and wooden dolls for tourists to bring home to their children. I loved him for the wrong reasons, and I wish that weren't the definition of love itself, but it is. He was so handsome in his captain's uniform, those medals like candy brimming over the cut-glass bowl of his heart. I always knew the latest rage, the mambo or cha-cha, and I'd stay out as late as I pleased even after you were born. And that you love me for. It's strange. Life's always seemed best in high, high heels with a gentleman who knows how to dance, no matter his conduct at home. He had the maid plait bougainvillea vines around our bed. Even now it sounds strange to say our. A different color for each post, scarlet, coral, apricot, and mauve. It was stunning, though not quite enough for me to bear someone looking at my body as anything but the carry-on bag packed with necessities it had always been for me. What I remember is the hotel pool the next morning, swimming in gardenias. Your father and I had gone through the war. Bodies meant something different then. Bodies in the dark. All I wanted, all I want is noise. All that's ever left me satisfied is the mariachi band outside my window, burnished trumpets blaring like taxi horns, the yellow braids on the guitarist's jackets twisting tighter as they cry to me from the loud, crowded street below. Canta y no llores. Sing, don't weep. Which is what I've always done. Okay, maybe I will conclude with just one very short poem from the title sequence of this book, Dragging the Lake. If you are dying and imagine yourself rising above the television, the parades and police barricades on the news, rising above the armoire with its regiment of black socks, and looking down on your body in gray pajamas and shearling slipper, tell me, in what way is that different from rising for real? It's not that unusual to meet someone who knows you better than you know yourself. So isn't imagination sometimes more accurate than experience? The glass of water, the book of Hemingway with the blue hard cover and silver lettering on the spine, and wire hangers strewn like lilies on the foot of the bed. Through the smudged window, the unmarked slab of the driveway, a car parked at an angle as if in a hurry. But there is no hurry. The chatter of sparrows, annoying as answering machines. The forgiveness the dead extend to the living. Passionate and absolute.
The poetry of Robert Thomas. For more information, you can go to www.robertthomaspoems.com. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are John Belch, Joseph Wilk, and Lauren Wolf. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, here on Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP.